even more insistent power as the pilot cut in the rocket engines that would thrust the plane high above the sensible atmosphere. He glanced at the girls. They were still gabbling away, oblivious to the plane's speed and angle of climb. Kids, Dan told himself. Well, at least she's not afraid of flying. He closed his eyes and tried to sleep, while either Lucita or Teresa turned on the plane's entertainment system to the loud, thumping beat of the latest Latino reggae rock music. Dan willed himself not to dream, and if he did dream, at least he remembered nothing of it when he awoke. 4 hours later, Dan sat on the straw mats of Saito Yamagata's living room floor, sipping hot Japanese tea and trying to convince himself that it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon and not 3 in the morning. The room was virtually bare of furnishings. Nothing but an exquisitely lacquered low table bearing the tea service and a pair of matched silk paintings on the walls to either side. Through the triple-glazed glass shoji screen that formed one side of the room, Dan could see the snow-covered mountains that sparkled in the afternoon sunshine. None of them was as perfect as the divine cone of Fujiyama, but the mountains were very pretty. They reminded Dan of Colorado and years gone by that could never be recaptured. "It was good of you to come all this way to see me," said Yamagata. He wore a Western-style business suit, perfectly tailored for his burly, short-limbed build. His round, smiling face had lines etched into it that Dan had not seen before, marks of worry. "I'll never phone you at 6 a.m. again," Dan said wearily. "Your revenge is too swift." Yamagata laughed, a hearty, belly-shaking bellow that reminded Dan of the old days. "I got the feeling," Dan said, "that you wanted to talk to me in private." The Japanese magnate grew serious. "Yes, it was necessary for us to have absolute confidence in the privacy of our discussion. This house is guarded by men whose families have served my family for many generations. We can speak here without fear of being overheard." "Good. You are concerned about the Russians' decision to increase the price of their lunar ores." "More than that," Dan said. "It's their stranglehold on us that bothers me. By controlling the mines on the moon, they control the raw materials that we use in our orbital factories. They've got their hands in our throat every minute of every day of every year." Yamagata closed his eyes and nodded. "Sooner or later, they're going to shut us down completely. You know that, don't you?" His friend said sadly, "They may close down your factories, Daniel, but not mine. You are an American, expatriate, but still an American. They fear you. They hate you."
"So do most Americans," Dan muttered.
"Nevertheless," Yamagata went on, "the Russians would be happy to close down your space operations. Only the fact that you have worked under the flag of Venezuela has stayed their hand, so far."
"They don't want to make the Third World mad at them, I know."
"But they will find a pretext for closing down all the other nations' space stations and all their factories. It is merely a matter of time."
"That includes you," Dan pointed out.
"Perhaps not," said Yamagata. "The Japanese space stations are under the informal protection of the People's Republic of China. Not even the Soviet Union has the courage to displease the Chinese."
"Not yet."
"Not for some time to come. China never relied so heavily on its nuclear missiles that it became powerless once the Russians perfected their space defenses. The Chinese still believe in manpower."
"With their population, why not?"
"1.5 billion at latest count.
Christ, they could walk to Moscow and the Russians wouldn't be able to stop them."
Yamagata pursed his lips. "The situation is not that simple. But suffice to say that for the foreseeable future, the Russians do not desire to antagonize the Chinese. And China looks favorably upon Japan's space-based industries."
"They're your principal market, aren't they?"
"For products manufactured in orbit, yes, of course. We sell quite a bit to India, too, despite their own space factories."
"We underprice them." He laughed again.
"So you're safe?"
"For the time being," Yamagata repeated. "And this Russian price increase?"
"We are attempting to negotiate an exception, although I don't think we will succeed. If not, then we will simply pass the cost on to our customers."
"That's something I can't do," Dan muttered.
"You mean that the government of Venezuela will not allow you to do it?"
Dan smiled at his old friend.
"Right. I don't own the operation. I just make the decisions and run the show." "A 25% increase in your costs would undoubtedly drive your operation into the red."
"And how?"
"Then what do you propose to do?"
"Get around them."
"How?"
Dan turned his gaze from his friend's careworn face to the snowy mountains in the distance, then looked back at Yamagata again. "You know me, Sai. When the going gets tough, the tough get going to wherever the going is easier," Yamagata finished for him. "Yes, I remember your motto. But where will the going be easier for you?"
"The asteroids."
Yamagata drew in his breath with an audible hiss.
"Ah, I should have guessed.
For every ounce of raw materials on the moon, there's tons and tons of the same stuff in the asteroids.
And heavy metals as well."
"Damned right. Enough iron in one little asteroid to feed Japan's steel industry for 20 years.
And there are thousands of such asteroids.
Millions of them," Dan said. "Sai, some of the smaller ones, just a few hundred meters across, are worth $10 billion apiece easily. Not to mention what the mile-long ones are worth."
"An expedition to the asteroids will be very costly, though," Yamagata mused, "and time-consuming."
"They lie beyond the orbit of Mars, don't they?"
"Most of them," Dan agreed, "but a few of them come closer, a lot closer.
Some of them even cross Earth's orbit."
"So you propose to reach one of these closer rocks?"
"Yes. Reach it and bring it back to Nueva Venezuela for processing."
"A daring plan. I had expected nothing less from you, my old friend."
Dan accepted it as a compliment. He took a sip of the hot, clear tea, then put the fragile cup back on the tray before him. His thighs were beginning to ache slightly. He had not sat cross-legged like this for so long in many years. He took a deep breath, almost letting the air hiss between his teeth in the Japanese way of showing respect.
"You probably know what I'm going to ask for next, Sai."
Yamagata gave a grunting, chuckling laugh.
"Money? What else?"
"I need your help."
"Yes, even to capture a nearby asteroid will require a considerable investment."
"I thought perhaps Yamagata Industries and Astro Manufacturing could go half and half."
"Yamagata Industries can do nothing," the Japanese said.
But before Dan could object, he smiled and raised a placating hand.
"There are certain delicacies to be observed, you see."
Dan raised his eyebrows.
"I, too, am faced with a government that is reluctant to incur the anger of the Soviet Union. Even with Chinese protection, the government of Japan moves very cautiously in such matters."
"The goddamned Russians have got everybody bullied," Dan grumbled.
"But there are certain affiliates of Yamagata Industries which operate in Okinawa and the Philippine Islands," Yamagata explained. "They, in turn, have associates in Europe. You would have no objection if your funding comes from a Swiss bank, would you?"
Grinning, Dan replied, "None whatsoever. Not even the Russians have been able to buffalo the gnomes of Zurich."
"Good. We can discuss the exact terms and other details later."
"I'm heading back to Caracas tomorrow, Sai."
"Yes, I thought you would be. I must attend a director's meeting tomorrow in Osaka."
"So we'll have to talk out the details before we both head our separate ways," Yamagata nodded.
"After dinner, then. For the present, I want you to meet my son."
"Nobuhiko? I thought he'd be out skiing."
"He is here."
Yamagata clapped his hands once.
"We have been quite alone, Daniel. The sound activates the house's intercom system."
In a louder voice, he called his son's name. Dan reached for his teacup again. It was blood red, with a tiny white heron painted in flight. Before he could put the cup down, the light paper shoji screen to his right slid back, and a tall, slim, smiling Japanese youth in his early 20s stepped into the room. For an instant, Dan blinked in surprise. The young man's face was exactly how Saito had looked years ago, when Dan had first met him up at the construction site of the first solar power satellite project. Nobuhiko Yamagata made a deep bow. Dan scrambled to his feet, grateful to stretch his legs after sitting on the floor so long.
"Nobu, you're a grown man."
Nobuhiko grinned and bowed again.
"Mr. Hamilton, it is such a pleasure to see you once again."
The young man wore skin-tight ski pants and a windbreaker, both bright blue with white stripes running down the sleeves and legs. His face was youthfully lean, but still the round, flat-nosed shape of his father's. His cheeks were reddened by a morning spent out in the cold and wind of the ski slopes. Nobu sat on his father's left, facing Dan, with his back to the view of the mountains. The robot servant rolled in with a fresh pot of tea and a cup for the young man. Yamagata did the pouring in silence with great care. After they had each sipped the scaldingly hot tea, Yamagata said,